A blue sign hurtles through space toward a blue planet. Turner. Now, sparks shoot out of a radio transmitter atop the revolving Earth. An RKO radio picture. Titles appear over a couple walking along a placid beach. RKO Radio Pictures presents I Walked with a Zombie, with James Ellison as Wesley Rand, Frances Dee as Betsy Connell, and Tom Conway as Paul Holland. This film is described for blind and visually impaired audiences by Descriptive Video Service, WGBH Boston. Described by Robin Sitton. Read by Marco Stage. Funded by the U.S. Department of Education. Screenplay by Kurt Siadmark and Artel Ray. Based on an original story by Inez Wallace. Music by Roy Webb. Copyright 1943. RKO Radio Pictures Incorporated. Produced by Val Lewton. Directed by Jacques Tourneur.
I walked with a zombie. Does seem an odd thing to say. Had anyone said that to me a year ago, I'm not at all sure I would have known what a zombie was. I might have had some notion that they were strange and frightening, even a little funny. It all began in such an ordinary way.
You're single?
Yes.
Where have you trained?
Memorial Hospital here in Ottawa.
You know, this last question's a little irregular, Miss Connell. I really don't know quite how to begin. Do you believe in witchcraft?
Well, they didn't teach it at Memorial Hospital, but I had my suspicions about the directress of training.
Now, as to salary, that's quite good. $200 a month.
That is good. But I'd like to know a little bit more about the case.
I'm afraid I can't tell you much. Only that the patient is the wife of Mr. Paul Holland, with whom we do considerable business.
Oh, that'll mean another interview.
No, this is quite final. You see, Mr. Holland is a sugar planter. He lives on St. Sebastian in the West Indies.
The West Indies?
That's not so bad. Sit under a palm tree, go swimming, take sun baths.
Outside, snow falls heavily.
Palm trees.
Later, at sea, a sailing ship's crew rests on the deck where a cook tends to an open flame. Its flickering light plays across their dark African faces. A white man stares at the horizon.
It seemed only a few days before I met Mr. Holland in Antigua. We boarded the boat for St. Sebastian. It was all just as I'd imagined it. I looked at those great glowing stars. I felt the warm wind on my cheek. I breathed deep. And every bit of me inside myself said, how beautiful.
It's not beautiful.
Nurse Betsy Connell turns from the ship's rail.
You read my thoughts, Mr. Holland.
It's easy enough to read the thoughts of a newcomer. Everything seems beautiful because you don't understand. Those flying fish, they're not leaping for joy. They're jumping in terror. Bigger fish want to eat them. That luminous water, it takes its gleam from millions of tiny dead bodies. Glitter of putrescence.
He purses his mustached lips.
There's no beauty here, only death and decay.
You can't really believe that.
They watch a falling star.
Everything good dies here, even the stars.
He returns to the bridge, where a dark-skinned pilot turns the ship's wheel.
It was strange to have him break in on my thoughts that way. There was cruelty and hardness in his voice. And yet something about him I liked. Something clean and honest. But hurt. Badly hurt.
Later, at the port of St. Sebastian, plantation workers carry 10-foot-long sugar canes in bundles onto Holland's ship. Betsy walks past market stalls where the black islanders buy and sell fresh food. She is a slender woman with wavy hair brushed back from her creamy white face. Later, she rides in a horse-drawn carriage. Leaning forward from the back seat, she listens to the driver.
Time's gone. Fort Holland was a fort, now no longer. The Hollands was the most old family, miss. They brought the colored folks to the island. The colored folks and T. Misery.
T. Misery? What's that?
A man, miss. An old man who lives in the garden at Fort Holland, with arrows stuck in him and a sorrowful, weeping look on his black face.
Alive?
No, miss. He's just the same as he was in the beginning, on the front side of an enormous boat.
You mean a figurehead.
If you say, miss, and the enormous boat brought the long-ago fathers and the long-ago mothers of us all chained to the bottom of the boat.
They brought you to a beautiful place, didn't they?
If you say, miss, if you say.
At the Fort Holland gate, the driver helps Betsy down from the fringe-top carriage. She wears a business-like suit and carries a coat and a tam hat. Standing at the estate's high iron gate, she peers through.
Fort Holland. From the gate it seemed strangely dreamlike. The garden had life of its own. I was to know all the nooks and crannies of that great house, to love them or hate them according to what happened there. In that house I was to hear a strange confession, a confession only madness could have wrung from the lips of a sane person. Yet it was in the same room, with the candles lit, that I made the discovery of my own love. New happiness deep through the heart. My room. I can still remember my delight, unpacking, getting ready for dinner. And yet all the while I wondered at the stillness of Fort Holland. The fact that I saw no one on the garden paths or in the rooms.
Brushing her hair at a vanity mirror, she notices a shadow outside.
Yes?
Miss Connell, it's dinner.
Oh, thank you.
Slatted blinds surrounding her spacious bedroom let in stripes of sunlight. Later, in the dining room, another man offers his hand.
Miss Connell?
Yes.
I'm Wesley Rand. Paul wanted me to introduce myself. Seems we're dining by ourselves, Miss Connell. But I think I'll introduce you to everyone anyway. Here in the master's chair sits the master. My half-brother, Paul Holland. Oh, but you've met him already.
Yes, on the boat.
He shows her a dimpled smile.
That chair in the corner is the particular property of Mrs. Rand. Mother to both of us and much too good for either of us. Too wise, in fact, to live under the same roof. She prefers the village dispensary.
Oh, she's a doctor?
No, she just runs the place. She does everything else, though. An amazing woman, Mother. You'd like her.
I like her already.
That's my chair. And this is Miss Connell, who is beautiful.
Thank you. Who sits there?
My brother's wife. Here, this isn't cozy at all. Makes me seem aloof, and I'm anything but that.
Later, Wesley pours liquor from a decanter.
But you're an American.
I went to school in Buffalo. Paul went to school in England.
Oh, I wondered about your different accents. I'm still wondering about your names, Rand and Holland.
We're half-brothers. Paul is Mother's first child. When his father died, she married my father, Dr. Rand, the missionary.
Betsy pauses with her coffee cup at her lips. Wesley gulps his drink.
The jungle drums. Mysterious. Eerie. That's the work drum over at the sugar mill. St. Sebastian's version of the factory whistle. As a matter of fact, it means that the sugar syrup is about ready to be poured. I'm afraid you'll have to excuse me.
Oh, of course. It was nice of you to spend this much time with me.
Don't worry, I wasn't missed. The only important man around here is the owner.
Mr. Holland?
Yes, the redoubtable Paul. He has the plantation, and I, as you must have noticed, have all the charm.
Oh, I don't know. He spoke to me on the boat last night, and I liked him very much.
Ah, yes. Our Paul. Strong and silent and very sad. Quite the Byronic character. Maybe I should cultivate it.
Maybe you ought to go to the mill.
It'll wait.
As he starts to pour another drink, Paul Holland arrives. Wesley sets down the glass and decanter.
I was just going to the mill. Good night, Miss Connell.
Good night.
A man enters with a dinner tray.
Have the servants made you comfortable?
Yes, thank you.
Looks very nice, Clement. I'll take it to Mrs. Holland.
Oh, can't I take it for you?
No, thank you. Tomorrow's soon enough for you to start work.
He takes the dinner tray from the servant, Clement, and strides off the terrace to a wooden door across the garden. He enters without knocking and shuts it behind him. Later that night, in her bedroom, Betsy winds an alarm clock and sets it beside the four-poster bed. She blows out a lamp, and moonlight filters in through the blinds. Lifting one of the pillows, she places it carefully at the foot of the bed. Then the garden courtyard draws her attention. She walks slowly to the slatted wall, which opens directly to the night air. Outside, among the lush ferns and jungle trees, she sees the figure of a woman in a white flowing gown. The woman drifts across the courtyard as if floating, then enters another door of the house. Turning away, Betsy removes her bathrobe and reveals a floor-length nightgown with a defined waist and draped bodice. Later that night, Betsy sits up in bed, her face awash in moonlight. Across the courtyard stands the windowless wooden door. Betsy blinks, alert, then a frown flashes across her face. Slipping out of the high double bed, she pulls on her bathrobe and walks through a door in the center of the slatted wall. A stiff breeze blows her robe open, and she cinches the belt tighter. Easing her hands into the robe's pockets, she walks across the courtyard to the unlocked door. Opening it, Betsy finds herself in the dark base of a tower. A freestanding staircase made of stone slabs leads up into the shadows. Betsy inches toward the bottom of the stairs, pausing to listen and peer into the darkness. Gathering the hems of her gown and robe, she starts up the staircase. Blackness closes around her. She feels her way along the bare wall as the narrow stairs wind higher. Her shadow looms behind her, distorting her shape. Hesitating, she glances over her shoulder. The figure in white enters below, from another room by the stairs. Through the open door, we glimpse a wooden dresser inside the room as the woman climbs the staircase. Farther up, Betsy pauses, where a shaft of light shines through an upper window.
Mrs. Holland!
As the woman draws closer, Betsy offers a friendly smile. The woman walks with downcast eyes and appears not to notice the nurse.
I didn't mean to get you up, Mrs. Holland.
The thin woman towers over Betsy as she walks straight toward her. Betsy bolts to the other side of the landing, where the staircase continues up. Mrs. Holland turns mechanically and walks back in Betsy's direction. Her sunken eyes are deathly black, her skin as tight as a corpse. Downstairs, Paul enters with two servants.
Jessica!
He bounds up the stairs with a flashlight. His wife obediently stops walking and comes to him.
Take Mrs. Holland to her room, Alma.
Come with Jessica. Come with Alma.
I heard someone crying. A woman.
A woman crying? There's been no crying here.
Mr. Paul? Yes, there was crying tonight. It was Alma. Her sister was brought a birthing.
Thank you, Clement.
Paul walks away, leaving Betsy on the upper stairs. Taking a breath, she follows him. With Clement's lantern lighting their way, Paul assists her on the worn steps. He wears loose-fitting pajamas and a satin-trimmed robe. At the bottom, Alma peeks out of the door to Mrs. Holland's room.
Clement, I'm going to stay with Miss Jessica in case the nurse lady takes to roaming again.
Don't you go crying anymore. That's what frightened Miss Betsy.
Well, she didn't suit me any hollering around in the tower.
Now, in the courtyard.
Why was the maid crying?
I'm not sure I can make you understand. You know what this is?
The figurehead.
Figure of St. Sebastian.
Yes. But it was once the figurehead of a slave ship. That's where our people came from the misery and pain of slavery. For generations, they found life a burden. That's why they still weep when a child is born and make merry at a burial.
They watch Clement plod wearily on his bare feet into the house.
I've told you, Miss Connell, this is a sad place.
In the morning, Paul's servant Alma enters Betsy Connell's sunlit room with a breakfast tray. She wears a long calico skirt and a cloth wrapped elaborately around her head. Pulling back the blanket, she wiggles Betsy's toe.
Good morning, miss.
Thank you for waking me.
I didn't want to frighten you out of your sleep, miss. That's why I touched your father's from your heart.
Betsy smiles widely.
Oh, don't get up, miss. I brought you a breakfast. Just like I do for Miss Jessica.
But I'm Miss Jessica's nurse, Alma. You don't have to do that for me.
I knew it, miss, but I like to do it. I'd like to tend for Miss Jessica, and I want to tend for you. You settle right back now, and I'll mix you your coffee.
Well, thank you.
Miss Jessica used to say this is the only way for a lady to break her fast, in bed with a lacy cushion to bank her head on. If you'd only seen her, Miss Connell, she looked so pretty.
She must have been beautiful.
What happened to her, Alma? She was very sick, and then she went mindless, miss.
Well, we'll see if we can't make her well, Alma. You and I.
I do my best. Every day I dress her just as beautifully as if she was well. It's just like dressing a great big doll.
She serves Betsy a popover.
What's this? A puff-up, I call it. But Miss Jessica always says brioche.
Looks like an awful lot of breakfast. I don't know whether I'll be able to get away with it.
It crushes under her fork. Later, in Paul's office.
I made it clear in my letter to the company this is not a position for a frightened girl.
I'm not a frightened girl.
That's hard to believe after what happened last night.
If I were as timid as you seem to think, Mr. Holland, I wouldn't have gone to the tower in the first place.
He sits back in his chair.
And what's so alarming about the tower, Miss Connell?
Nothing, really, but you must admit it's an eerie sort of place. So dark.
Surely nurses aren't afraid of the dark.
Of course not. Well, I used to be afraid of the dark when I was a child, but I'm not afraid anymore.
Betsy wears her white uniform and nurse's cap.
Frankly, it was something of a shock to see my patient that way for the first time. Nobody had told me Mrs. Holland was a mental case.
Paul straightens his shoulders.
A mental case?
I'm sorry.
Why should you be? My wife is a mental case. Please remember that, Miss Connell. Particularly when some of the foolish people on the island start regaling you with local legends. You'll find superstition a contagious thing. Some people let it get the better of them. I don't think you will.
No.
Come along. I'll introduce you to Dr. Maxton, your patient.
Later.
I can't tell you how glad I am to have you here, Miss Connell.
I know I'll enjoy working with you, Doctor.
I have an enormous...
Bright sunlight fills Jessica's cheerily furnished room.
I always feel them behind my back, looking at their training manuals, counting my mistakes.
I'll keep tabs on you.
Jessica lies in a curtained bed.
She makes a beautiful zombie, doesn't she?
Pitiful.
I knew Jessica. We were friends. Sometimes it's better for a doctor to laugh than pull a long face when things are hopeless.
Yes, I know. But I don't know about zombies, Doctor. Just what is a zombie?
A ghost, a living dead. It's also a drink.
Yes, I tried one once, but there wasn't anything dead about it.
But we've a more serious problem to deal with, Miss Connell. You want to know about your patient, don't you?
Please.
I'll try to put it simply. Mrs. Holland had a tropical fever, very severe. We might say that portions of the spinal cord were burned out by this fever. The result is what you see, a woman without any willpower, unable to speak or even act by herself, though she will obey simple commands.
Does she suffer?
I don't know. I'd rather think of her as a sleepwalker who can never be awakened. Feeling nothing, knowing nothing. There's very little we can do except keep her physically comfortable, light diet, some exercise.
She can never be cured?
I've never heard of a cure.
Could you give me some details of treatment and diet?
I prepared these for you last night.
Thank you.
I'll drop by in a day or so to see how you're getting on.
Later, Betsy returns to the main house. Paul sits on the terrace.
You didn't find your patient so frightening in the daylight, did you?
And Mrs. Holland must have been very beautiful.
Many people thought her beautiful.
He looks at his newspaper.
Tell me, Miss Connell, do you consider yourself pretty?
I don't know. I suppose so.
And charming?
I've never given it much thought.
Don't. You will save yourself a great deal of trouble and other people a great deal of unhappiness.
She raises her thin eyebrows, then leaves. Later, Betsy walks through town in her suit, idly swinging her tam hat. Black Islanders pass her busily. An old man leans on a fruit cart. Wesley Rand approaches on horseback in rolled shirt sleeves and khaki pants. He smiles cheerily as he leans one muscular arm on the horse's back.
Betsy, where are you going?
It's my day off.
What in the world can you do with the day off in St. Sebastian?
I was just beginning to wonder. Aren't there shops and restaurants and things here?
Well, and things is a better description of what you'll find. I'd better come along and show you the town.
Oh, don't you have to work?
By a curious coincidence, it's my day off, too.
Later, at a sidewalk cafe.
Some talk of Alexander and some of Hercules, of Hector and Lysander and some great names as these. But of all the world's great heroes, there's none that can...
See, Joseph, better bring me another. I have to keep the lady entertained.
Must be hard work entertaining me if it requires 6 ounces of rum.
6 ounces?
Her mathematics. 2 ounces to a drink, 3 drinks, 6 ounces.
Well, how did you know there were 2 ounces in a drink?
I'm a nurse. I always watch people when they pour something. I watched T. Joseph, and it was exactly 2 ounces.
Wesley's grin fades. He shifts uncomfortably as he notices Betsy listening to the folk singer's song.
A long, long while, the head of the family was a Holland man, and the younger brother, his name was Rand.
Listen, did I ever tell you the story about the little mule on the plantation? The little mule and Clement.
Wait a minute, I want to listen.
The Holland man, he kept in a tower, a wife as pretty as a big white flower. She saw the brother, and she stole his heart, and that's how the badness and the trouble start.
Wesley angrily sends the waiter over to the performer.
Tim Alice, you tripped up my tongue. What do you wish troubling me for? You saw Mr. Rand go in there. Why don't you tell me? Apologize, that's what I'll do. Creep in just like a little fox and warm myself in his heart.
I wouldn't have listened, Wesley, if I'd realized that.
The round-faced singer bows at their table.
Mr. Rand, I've come to apologize.
All right.
Just an old song I picked up somewhere. Don't know who did make it up.
All right, all right.
Some of these singers on this island, they tattletale on anybody. Believe me, Mr. Rand, I never would sing that song if I'd known you were with the lady.
Get out of here.
The singer bows again.
Don't let it bother you so, Wesley.
You heard what he sang? Shocked?
I just wish I hadn't heard.
Why? Everybody else knows it. Paul sort of that. Sometimes I think he planned the whole thing from the beginning just to watch me squirm.
That doesn't sound like him.
Oh, that's right. He's playing the noble husband for you, isn't he? Well, that won't last long.
I think we'd better go now. Will you take me home?
One of these days he'll start on you just like he did on her. You think life's beautiful, don't you, Jessica? You think you're beautiful, don't you, Jessica? What he could do to that word beautiful... That's Paul's great weapon, words. He uses them like other men use their fists.
He takes a long drink from his glass. Betsy frowns and looks away. Nightfall at the cafe. As waiters light gas lanterns under the canopy, Betsy stands. Opposite her, Wesley rests his cheek on the table.
Wes, it's time we started home.
The wife and the brother, they want to go. But the Holland man, he tell them no. The wife fall down and the evil came. And it burned her mind in the fever flame.
Wes! Wes, we must get back to Fort Holland.
Shame and sorrow for the family. Her eyes are empty and she cannot talk. And the nurse has come to make her walk. The brothers are lonely and the nurse is young. And now you must see that my song is sung.
The singer slowly approaches Betsy as she stands over the drunken Wesley and fixes her with a penetrating stare. An older woman arrives and strides toward their table, driving the folk singer away. Her gray streaked hair is pulled back tightly from her pale face.
I think you need some help.
I'm afraid so. See, Joseph?
Wesley lifts his head.
Get Mr. Rand onto his horse and start him toward the fort.
Oh, but he's in no condition to ride. I don't think he could even sit in the saddle.
Don't worry about a sugar planter. Give him a horse and he'll ride to his own funeral.
The woman clutches an alligator bag to her plain wool suit.
I really intended going out to the fort and meeting you long before this, Miss Connell. I'm Mrs. Rand, Wesley's mother.
Oh, Mrs. Rand,
Now, don't tell me you're sorry that I should meet you this way. I'm even a little glad that Wesley's difficulties brought us together.
Believe me, he doesn't do this often. It's...
Nonsense. I know Wesley's been drinking too much lately. I know a great deal more about what goes on at the fort than you'd think.
She pays their bill.
I know all about you. But you're a nice girl, competent, and kind to Jessica. The fort needs a girl like you. Come, I must get you back there. I'll walk back with you and stay the night.
The change will do me good.
Thank you, Mrs. Rand. I think you're every bit as nice as Wesley says you are.
So, he says I'm nice. He's a nice boy, too, Miss Connell, a very nice boy. I'm worried about his drinking, though.
She links arms with Betsy.
You could do me a great favor.
I'd love to.
Use your influence with Paul. Ask him to take the whiskey decanter off the dinner table.
I have no influence with Mr. Holland.
Try it. You may have more than you think.
In the morning, Paul and a foreman inspect a stalk of cane.
No, it's not a drought, Bayard. Rain's just a little late, that's all.
I've seen the drought before, Mr. Holland. The cane's too dry, and it's dangerous that way.
Good morning.
Betsy.
Good morning.
I heard about your little misadventure yesterday. On your first day off, too.
Oh, I had a good time up to a point.
Wes can be very entertaining.
Yes, he can. But I was wondering, you know, if you could leave the whiskey decanter off the table.
It's always stood there, Miss Connell. I can remember it in my grandfather's time, and my father's.
But it must be an added temptation to Wesley, and though your brother's not an alcoholic yet, Mr. Holland, I can tell you as a nurse that it won't be long.
Miss Connell, I engaged you to take care of my wife, not my brother. I'm afraid the decanter will have to stay where it is.
He turns sharply and continues on his way. That night, the brothers dine with Betsy. Paul sits at the head of the table, opposite Jessica's empty chair.
There they go.
Bayard told me they were going to ask Dumbala for rain. He was as dry as dust.
But what is it, Mr. Holland?
It's a big seashell, a conch. They make a sort of bugle out of it to call the faithful to the home fort.
But I don't know what a home fort is, or a Dumbala.
It's voodoo. The home fort is the temple.
And Dumbala is one of the gods, the big papa god.
You don't seem very disturbed by it. I thought voodoo was something everyone was frightened of.
I'm afraid it's not very frightening. They sing and dance and carry on. And then, as I understand it, one of the gods comes down and speaks through one of the people.
Wesley squirms.
For some reason, they always pick a night like this. This hot wind even sets me on edge.
He reaches down the table.
Clement, you've forgotten the decanter.
I think from now on, Wes, we'll try serving dinner without it.
That's odd. What are you trying to do, impress Miss Connell?
You'd make a better impression without whiskey.
Thank you. You've always had such tender concern for me. And for Jessica.
Let's drop it, Wes.
Why?
It isn't considered polite to quarrel before ladies.
Oh, I see. Let's be reserved and gentlemanly. You were so reserved and gentlemanly, so polite that night with Jessica. I remember...
Wes!
Wesley freezes, halfway out of his chair. Paul lays aside his napkin.
Miss Connell, I think it would be better if I had Clement bring the rest of your dinner to your room.
Betsy lowers her eyes, then rises stiffly and leaves them. Later in her room, she leans on an armchair. Through the courtyard, she sees Paul seated at a piano in another room. Idly fingering a handkerchief, Betsy listens. Suddenly, she stands and strides out of the bedroom through the wooden doors, now opened wide to the evening breeze. Paul gazes ahead as he plays without music. His black hair is combed high above his smooth forehead and neatly groomed eyebrows. As she opens his door, he glances over his shoulder, then turns on the bench.
I heard you playing.
I often do.
She speaks hesitantly.
I know what you went through tonight. I kept thinking of what you said, that all good things died here violently.
Paul walks toward her in the doorway.
Why did you come in here?
I don't know.
She wads the handkerchief.
I wanted to help you, and now that I'm here, I don't know how.
You have helped me. I want you to know that I'm sorry I ever brought you here. When I thought of a nurse, I thought of someone hard and impersonal.
I love Fort Holland.
And what you saw tonight... Two brothers set against each other, and a woman driven mad by her own husband. Do you love that?
You didn't drive her mad.
He eyes her hand on his arm. His face softens.
Before Jessica was taken ill, there was a scene. An ugly scene. I told her she couldn't go, that I'd keep her here by force if necessary. You never knew Jessica as she was.
Paul stiffens haughtily.
I think it would be best for all of us not to discuss this again. Thank you. I know you meant to be kind.
He stares down his long nose at her until she leaves the room. Later, Betsy walks alone along a rocky beach path.
I don't know how their own love is revealed to other women. Maybe in their sweethearts' arms, I don't know. To me, it came that night after Paul Holland had almost thrust me from the room. Certainly from his life. I said, I love him. Even as I said it, I knew he still loved his wife. And then because I loved him, I felt I had to restore her to him. To make her what she'd been before. To make him happy.
Later, in Jessica's airy tower room, Paul paces the floor.
All that you say comes to the same thing. You're asking me to pass a sentence of life or death on my wife.
Insulin shock treatment is an extreme measure, Paul. As Miss Connell pointed out when she suggested it to me, but...
You admit that this is terribly dangerous, so why do you advise it?
I've worked with it. I've seen cures. It's at least a hope.
It's the very danger itself, Paul, that makes the cure possible. Insulin produces a state of coma. Then the patient is revived by a violent shock to the nerves. That shock can kill, but it can also cure.
Paul locks his hands behind his back.
I don't know.
It's a hard decision to make, but yours is only a technical responsibility.
Technical responsibility, real responsibility? Question is, will she live or die?
You're wrong, Mr. Holland. It isn't a question of life or death. Your wife isn't living. She's in a world that's empty of joy or meaning. We have a chance to give her life back to her.
Paul glances at Dr. Maxwell, then lets his gaze fall. Later, Jessica lies in her curtained bed under the light of a single lamp. Betsy stands by with a tray of instruments while Dr. Maxwell checks the patient's pulse. In the doorway, Paul waits, with his thumbs hooked in the waistband of his khaki pants. Betsy comes to him, and he searches her face.
Well?
She's alive, that's all.
He grabs Betsy's shoulders.
Don't take it so much to heart, Betsy.
I imagined it so differently.
I've been waiting for hours, trying to imagine Jessica well again.
And I come bringing you nothing.
Instead, you come bringing me sympathy, Betsy, and a generous heart. Don't forget that. Don't call that nothing.
Someone stands in the shadows between them.
Very sad.
Wesley.
Very sweet. The noble husband and the noble nurse comforting each other because the patient still lives. I've been imagining too, Paul. Only I didn't have to wonder how I'd feel. I do. I'm not in love with another woman.
Wesley abruptly leaves the room. Later, a group of Paul's servants gathers in the courtyard. Betsy notices them as she leaves the tower. A bronze-skinned islander holds a newborn baby wrapped in blankets. As Betsy approaches, smiling, Alma meets her.
Oh, I'm sorry, Miss Betsy. I'll take it right away.
Oh, is this your sister's baby?
Yes, Miss Betsy. This is little T. Victor and my sister, Melise.
Oh, I'm so glad I came out. I've been wanting to meet you, Melise.
More so, Miss.
Oh, he's a wonderful baby.
It's beautiful, yes. He's chosen you, Miss.
That's what we say, Miss Betsy, when a baby first goes visiting. Those he smiles at will be his friends.
Well, that makes me very proud. Here, T. Victor.
She fastens a pin to his sweater.
So you won't forget I'm your friend.
Thanks, Miss Betsy.
As the visitors leave with Melise and her baby, Alma stays behind with Betsy.
It's nice to see people so happy. They're not always happy, Miss Betsy.
I suppose not. Things so bad, nobody can help. Not even Dr. Maxwell.
Doctors and nurses can only do so much, Alma.
They can't cure everything. Doctors that are people can't cure everything.
You mean doctors that are people?
There are other doctors. Yes, other doctors. Better doctors.
Where?
At the Homeford.
That's nonsense, Alma.
They even cure nonsense, Miss Betsy. Mama Rose was mindless. I was at the Homeford when the Hungan brought her mind back.
Was Mama Rose like Mrs. Holland?
No. She was mindless, but not like Miss Jessica. But the Hungan cured her.
Are you trying to tell me that the voodoo priest could cure Mrs. Holland?
Yes, Miss Betsy. I mean that. The Hungan will speak to the Rada drums, and the drums will speak to Leyba and Dambala.
Alma smiles with wonder.
Better doctors.
Later, at the dispensary, Mrs. Rand applies salve on a young boy's dark chest. She notices the fetish bag tied around his neck.
T. Peter, how do you ever expect to get to heaven with one foot in the voodoo home foot and the other in the church? I'll get along with you.
She turns to Betsy.
Some of this native nonsense. The Hung John has his prescription, and Dr. Maxwell and I have ours.
You've never talked about voodoo before, Mrs. Rand.
Haven't I? I suppose I take it for granted. It's just part of everyday life here.
You don't believe in it?
A missionary's widow? Isn't very likely, is it?
Well, I don't mean believe in it like believing in a religion. I mean, do you believe it has power? Do you think it could cure a sick person?
Frankly, my dear, I didn't expect anything like that from a nice, level-headed girl like you. What are you driving at?
Well, I heard the servants talking about Mama Rose. They said she'd been mindless.
Her son drowned. It affected her mind. The Hung Gong cured her by giving her a little practical psychology.
While Mrs. Rand busies herself putting away instruments, Betsy stares ahead blankly.
What if I took Jessica to see him?
You don't know what goes on at the Humfort. It might be very dangerous to take her there. Dangerous for both of you. These people are primitive. Things that are natural to them might shock and horrify you.
Betsy avoids her gaze.
I'm not easily frightened.
That may be the pity of it.
Later at Fort Holland, Paul passes an evening at work in his room. On the front porch, Wesley drinks and smokes a cigarette. A strong wind stirs his necktie and the standing palms along the stone walkways. Betsy emerges through a side door, leading Jessica by the hand. The tall woman, still in her flowing gown, looks at the ground as she follows Betsy, who pulls her dark nurse's cape tightly around her. In a shadowed opening between garden walls, Alma waits for them.
I'm going to the home fort, Alma.
In a room off the courtyard, Alma spills sugar on the floor. Squatting, she draws a map in it with her finger.
You go right from the mill to an obeah sign in the cane. Here, you turn and face a banyo tree on the hill. Walk toward it and keep walking. Keep walking, Miss Betsy, and you'll come to the crossroads. There's a guard there, Carrefour. He keeps the crossroads, but he won't do you no harm. When he sees the voodoo patches, he'll let you pass.
She pins a light cloth to Betsy's cape, then a dark one on Jessica's gown. Now, in the fields, a figure as tall as the stalks of cane stands guard. Betsy and Jessica work their way through the crop rows, which surround them like a dense forest. Jessica stands a head taller than Betsy, who pulls her along by the hand. An animal's skull on a stake stands in the cane to their right. Betsy shines her flashlight over its smooth, broad bone. Blinking rapidly in the strong wind, she marches toward it, assisting Jessica with a gentle push on her arm. Farther down the row, the field opens. A rotting goat hangs in a tree against a cloud-streaked sky. Hesitating, Betsy glances at Jessica, then takes her up the small rise. They pass beneath the goat and re-enter the path through the cane. Jessica's tilted face stares unfocused as she stops and starts, following Betsy's steps. Betsy crouches, peering ahead, then switches on the flashlight. A crude wooden structure blocks their path. In its center hangs a hooked gourd carved with intricate circular patterns. Betsy takes Jessica's hand in both of hers and trudges forward deeper into darkness. Dried leaves brush Betsy's cheek as she walks the edge of the cane row. Suddenly she stops before a human skull, with its jaw detached, nestled in a circle of white stones. As they pass it, Jessica's frayed gown trails through the circle. Her dark eyes open wide, Betsy looks over her shoulder, then pushes through the cane. The triangular voodoo patch snags on a stalk and tears loose. On the dark path, the flashlight finds a black man's foot, then the giant guard himself. The guard's eyes stare, undisturbed by the bright light. Betsy grabs for her missing patch, then notices Jessica's still attached. Gripping her charge's hand tighter, she inches around the guard, who makes no move to stop them. After the women pass, the 7-foot guard leaves the crossroads. His shirtless, hunched back disappears behind the cane. The women pass under a tangled arch of vines, then into a grove of jungle vegetation. Betsy pauses, listening to the unseen musicians. Hastening her steps, she charges into a patch of high cane and emerges at the edge of a lighted clearing. Under a wooden pavilion, islanders dressed in white stand in an open circle around a dirt floor. Outside the pavilion, a woman holds a live white chicken. In the circle, a man in black performs a dance with a saber. Betsy brings Jessica closer to the rim of the circle, where island men wear voodoo patches like hers. The dancer holds the saber over his head and performs high marching steps. His shoulders and lithe hips thrust forward with the movement of the sword. A woman pushes into the circle and sways toward the dancer, with her arms rocking loosely at her sides. She is light-skinned, with a patterned cloth around her head. The swordsman circles her with the flat of his blade before his face, while she gracefully rolls her weight from foot to foot. Another man dabs a substance from a gourd on her eyes, nose, and forehead. She continues to sway, and the dancer in black thrusts his sword overhead. The dancer stabs the sword down as if in a sheath. Bobbing his head from side to side like a serpent, he wriggles in front of her. With her eyes closed, she sinks in a heap to the ground. Two worshippers lift her, and an older woman takes the floor. In a long cotton skirt, the new dancer flails her arms powerfully at the ground. Betsy eyes the crowd nervously. The dancing woman moves back into the crowd, then two young women in short dresses leap around a single drummer who kneels under the pavilion. Their chests burst forward and their elbows back as they pound the earth with their feet. With the drummer between them, they lower themselves until their cloth-wrapped foreheads touch. They lay their arms to the sides and crouch further until their chins hover over the drummer's furiously beating hands.
Let them dance and be happy.
Betsy takes Jessica's hand and follows the worshippers. They stand in line before a shed, where a web-like design decorates a door. Each worshipper approaches the door and speaks to it, leaning close to listen. An old woman in front of Betsy serenely touches her face to the chalk design. A tuft of gray hair curls from under her headscarf. Her ebony skin wrinkles as she speaks. As the old woman departs, Betsy steps boldly toward the Humfort door. The door opens and a white hand draws Betsy in. An attendant follows, leaving Jessica standing outside. Inside, someone lights a lantern and a familiar woman eyes Betsy.
Mrs. Rand.
I knew you'd come. I couldn't let you go back without some word. I came here to tell you again, Jessica cannot be cured.
What are you doing here?
Outside, the islanders gather around Jessica. She stands with her head tilted to the side. Her sheer patch billows in the wind. A woman exchanges a grave glance with the dancer in black. Driving his sword into the earth, he receives another blade from her and holds it up before his face, in the Humfort shed.
And when my husband died, I was helpless. they disobeyed me. And accidentally, I discovered the secret of how to deal with them. There was a woman with a baby. Again and again, I begged her to boil the drinking water. She wouldn't. Then I told her the god Shango would kill the evil spirits in the water if she boiled it. From then on, she boiled the water.
But that still doesn't explain why you're here.
Perhaps not, but I am here. It seems so simple to let the gods speak through me. I should have known there's no easy way to do good, Betsy.
Outside, Jessica remains rigid, her face turned aside, as the swordsman advances toward her. His sharp Latin features and his upturned lip give his face an ominous sneer. He sharply raises one hand with a flourish, and she lifts hers in response. Grasping her frail wrist, he turns her arm toward him, then drives the sword tip into it. Jessica's face remains placid as the swordsman releases the hilt, leaving the blade quivering in her forearm.
She doesn't bleed.
Zombie.
She doesn't bleed.
Mrs. Rand pushes past Betsy to the Humfort door.
Get her back to the fort, Betsy. Do as I say. They won't hurt you.
The islanders surround Jessica, now free of the sword, and inspect her wound.
Leave them alone. Let them go.
Betsy hurries back, pulling Jessica along beside her past the banyan tree and the swinging goat, then through the cane fields to Fort Holland. Later, Betsy leaves the tower and creeps quickly across the darkened courtyard to her own room. Paul steps from the shadows.
Where have you been, Miss Connell?
She sweeps a hand through her thick hair.
I wanted to help you.
Help me? How?
I took Mrs. Holland to the home fort. I thought they might cure her.
There's no telling what you may have started with this insanity. Because you wanted to give my wife back to me. Why should that mean so much to you?
You know why. You saw it the other night, the piano.
What I saw the other night, I could hardly believe, Betsy. I thought I was looking at a woman who had compassion for me, who loved me. And yet you made that trip to the home fort to bring Jessica back to me. You, the nurse who's afraid of the dark.
He grips her shoulders and she looks into his eyes.
Yes.
You think I love Jessica and want her back. It's like you to think that. Clean, decent thinking.
His hands fall to his sides.
I wish it were true. Perhaps for your sake.
He looks in the direction of the Humfort, and Betsy's gaze follows his. The next day, Alma tries to rein a horse.
Mind me now, horse. Come away from there.
It nibbles at the flowers around the figurehead.
Are you ever stubborn, just like that old saber man at the Humfort? Sticking your nose in places where it isn't wanted. Making trouble for everybody.
Betsy joins her at the statue.
Alma, you try it this way.
She leads the horse away.
Turn your back on him. You see, that's the way it is with a horse. You can't look at him and lead him at the same time.
Sounds sort of manlike, doesn't it?
Whose horse?
The police horse.
Police? I didn't know there was a policeman on the island.
Oh, just this horse, Miss Betsy. When they asked the commissioner if any policemen were wanted, he said, my horse is all the police we need on St. Sebastian.
Commissioner?
Yes, Miss Betsy. I expect there's some trouble. Not just little trouble like Mr. Rand gets into when he's been drinking more than a little, but real big trouble.
You don't suppose it's because I took Mrs. Holland to the Humfort, do you?
They haven't been talking loud enough for me to hear, Miss Betsy. But I've been holding this horse for coming on close to an hour, and they've been just talking and talking. I feel it's something very bad.
Betsy smiles calmly.
Will you have a horse to hold, Alma? And Mrs. Rand has asked me to have a cup of tea with her.
Alma yanks the reins.
Of course you stand still.
Now, at the Humfort, the swordsman lowers a blonde doll before the women dancers, who dress it in a long, flowing gown. The swordsman sits cross-legged above them, overlooking the Humfort drummers. Lifting the doll again, he waves a hand over its blonde head. In the tower room, Betsy covers the sleeping Jessica with a satin quilt and pulls closed the sheer mosquito netting. An extra pillow lies on a nearby daybed. Paul enters.
You're staying here with Jessica tonight, Betsy?
Mrs. Rand thought it might be best.
She's right.
He looks somberly at his wife.
I've caused you so much trouble, Paul.
Oh, no. It was bound to come. As a matter of fact, that's why I'm here. I want to talk to you. Perhaps when you're finished in here, you'd come into the garden.
Is it about this afternoon? I saw the commissioner here.
Jeffries? Yes, he was here. He and Maxwell. They're in a great stew about it. Seems those people up at the home fort won't stop drumming and dancing until they've gotten Jessica back and finished their ritual tests. Something of that sort. For her own safety, Jeffries and Maxwell want Jessica sent away to St. Thomas, to the asylum.
Might be best.
Maybe. But Wesley insists she stay here.
But he hasn't the right.
Oh, he hasn't any legal right, if that's what you mean. But he says that I'm responsible for Jessica's illness, that I deliberately drove her insane.
You couldn't have done that, Paul.
I don't know. I've gone over it and over it, and I don't know.
Now, at the home fort, the crossroads guard, Carrie Four, holds the blonde doll in the palm of his upturned hand. The swordsman, chest high to the wall-eyed guard, closes the man's hands around the doll's feet, then backs slowly away. As worshippers watch, the swordsman removes the doll and gestures. Carrie Four follows, never blinking, and takes back the doll. With deliberate slowness, the swordsman in black repeats the move. Carrie Four obeys. With firelight flickering over every sinew of his lanky arms and lean chest, he clutches the doll in a tight fist. Now, in the garden courtyard.
I want you out of it. I want you to go back to Canada, Betsy.
Why?
Because of Jessica, because of myself, because I don't want you to be made miserable and unhappy.
But I want to stay.
I'm afraid it's not what you want. I want you back in Canada.
Naturally, as my employer, you have the right to dismiss me.
Don't, Betsy. You know that isn't what I mean. You remember the first night I saw you? You were looking at the sea. You were enchanted. But I felt I had to destroy that enchantment, make you see ugliness and cruelty.
You were trying to warn me.
No. I was trying to hurt you. It was the same way with Jessica. I had to hurt her. Everything she did or said made me lash out at her. That's why I want you to go. You see, Betsy...
He caresses her hand.
Since you've been here, I've seen how fine and sweet things can be between a man and a woman. How love can be calm and good. I'd rather not have that sort of love than have it and destroy it.
You want me to leave you?
That's why I want you to go. It's no good for you to stay so long as I have this fear of myself.
Betsy buries her face in Paul's chest. Later, as she sleeps in Jessica's room, a breeze stirs a harp by the window. Betsy sleeps peacefully, one hand tucked near her smooth cheek. In the courtyard, a broad-shouldered shadow falls over the flagstones. It approaches Jessica's windows and rises against the wall over the daybed where Betsy sleeps. Betsy's eyes snap open. She slowly lifts her head and listens alertly. Rising on one elbow, she pulls back her blanket and sheet. Her eyes fixed on Jessica, she swings her feet to the floor. Curly-cued silhouettes of the estate's iron fence surround the room's high white walls. Sheer white draperies part for the gusty breeze. Walking to Jessica's bed, she finds her sleeping soundly. Turning, Betsy looks back at the bedroom door, which leads to the tower. She puts on a long white robe, which hangs in draped folds under her sleeves, and steps carefully across the room. Opening the door, she peers into the tower's dark interior. Finding nothing, she steps through the door. Outside the tower, the garden lies in darkness. From where she stands, Betsy can see through the open tower door to Jessica's room. As she glances in, her forehead creases deeply. Moonlight, filtered through the trees, illuminates her white gown. She creeps forward on the walk, pauses, and stares into another doorway in the stone tower wall. In one of the garden's pools, a frog hops to safety. An owl over her head. Betsy smiles and relaxes. Looking back at the second doorway, she notices it appears to open. She backs away, then runs to the cover of the ferns nearest the house. Where she stood seconds before, the shadow now covers the walk. Betsy's eyes flash. As the shadow moves steadily toward her, she lifts the hem of her gown and races down the covered terrace to Paul's room.
Paul!
Carrie Four shuffles closer, his heels dragging the floor with each step. His bulging eyes gleam through the darkness.
What are you doing here?
Paul steps forward threateningly.
Get out of here.
The guardsman raises his gangly arms and approaches. His lips part and his glassy eyes appear frozen.
Carrefour!
Mrs. Rand.
Carrefour, go back.
He lets his arms fall, turns around, and walks mechanically away. Paul starts to chase him.
Paul, let him go. Don't touch him. Don't try to stop him.
Carrefour continues toward the main gate, his arms hanging at his sides and his feet scraping the ground. He walks through the open door and into the night. In the morning, Mrs. Rand finishes addressing a small package at Paul's desk. Betsy brings her a container of postage stamps.
I can send this off by the next boat. If you have any letters, you better get them ready, Betsy, to go with this parcel.
Any news I have can wait till I get home.
Be pretty stale by that time.
Perhaps not, Mother. Betsy is leaving us.
Well, Betsy, we can't lose you. We've grown to depend on you. I have, and I know Paul has.
Mother, Betsy has her reasons.
Mrs. Rand cocks her head at her.
I hope you won't feel I'm deserting you or think badly of me.
Think badly of you, Betsy.
Wesley enters with the doctor.
Dr. Maxwell has some unpleasant news for us.
An accident at the mill.
No, it's about Jessica. A result of our discussion the other day, I'm afraid.
What about her?
Well, in view of all the circumstances, some of the things Wesley's been saying, and the fact that one of the voodoo people got into your house last night, the commission has decided on a legal investigation.
In other words, I'm on trial.
Oh, I wouldn't put it that way, Paul, but there's been a lot of talk. The whole thing's getting out of hand.
A pretty scene. Half the island crowding into the courtroom to watch our dirty linen get a public scrubbing.
Wait a bit, Wes. Let's talk this over.
Talk it over. Talk now, Paul, and tell them that you're not responsible. That every bit of this doesn't rest squarely on your shoulders.
Mrs. Rand steps forward.
If you'll be good enough to take me to the commissioner, Doctor, I think there'll be no need of an investigation.
But why, Mrs. Rand? What could you have to tell him?
Jessica is not insane. Please take me to the commissioner. I can explain the whole thing to him.
Mother, what are you trying to say?
She is dead.
Oh, Mrs. Rand.
She is dead. Living and dead.
Mrs. Rand, you're not seriously trying to tell me that my patient is a zombie.
I'm not mad. It's true. I did it.
Mother.
Wesley, let me explain. I wanted to so often. Now I have to. Betsy, tell them about the Humfort. Tell them what you saw there.
Betsy looks away.
You must, Betsy. They'll have to believe you.
Well, Mrs. Rand was at the Humfort, but there's nothing wrong with that. She's gone there for years, trying to take care of those people, to help them.
I think I understand. I've often talked a little voodoo to get medicine down a patient's throat.
But it was more than that, Doctor. I entered into their ceremonies. I pretended I was possessed by their gods. What I did to Jessica. It's when she wanted to go away with Wesley. That night I went to the Humfort. I kept seeing her face smiling because she was beautiful enough to take my family in her hands and tear it apart. The drums, the chanting, the lights. I heard a voice speaking in the sudden silence. My voice. I was speaking to the Hungan. I was possessed. I told him the woman at Fort Holland was evil and asked him to make her a zombie.
Then what happened?
I hated myself.
On the way home, I said over and over again, there are no such people. And no strange drugs. There's no such thing as a zombie.
You were right.
I said it and I made myself believe it. But when I got here, Jessica was raging with fever.
She was raging with fever. A fever with a long Latin name and a bad reputation for its after effects. Usually some form of insanity.
Dr. Maxwell is right, Mother.
You were tricked by your own imagination, Mrs. Rand.
But I'm not an imaginative or fanciful woman, Doctor.
As I understand it, in order to turn a person into a zombie, whether by poison or hocus-pocus, you must first kill that person. Is that right?
Yes.
She was feverish. She was delirious. But I don't remember her dying. Or even being in a state resembling death. No coma. Nothing.
She looks pleadingly in Betsy's direction.
I'm afraid you are an imaginative woman, Mrs. Rand.
With heavy steps, she walks up a short flight of stairs out of Paul's office. On the landing, Betsy reaches her arm around her and helps her up the next flight. Wesley touches his brother's shoulder as their mother walks away. Now at the Humfort, a string moves Jessica's doll over the loose earth. The swordsman squats on his heels and pantomimes pulling the doll toward him. Jessica leaves the tower with Betsy close behind her. Paul sees them from his doorway.
Jessica?
Jessica heads toward the gate.
Jessica? She won't obey.
Jessica!
Betsy quickly grabs the gate, pushes it closed, and latches it. At the Humfort, the swordsman hops on his heels as the doll draws closer. Now, Wesley stands outside the gate.
It's the Humfort. Trying to get her back.
But how can they? How could they make her understand? How would she know?
They know how. They have charms that can draw a man halfway around the world. Opiate tricks, magic. Everybody knows that.
We may have believed all that when we were boys, Wes. But we're grown men now. We know it's all nonsense.
Do we?
Yes.
You've forgotten?
I've not forgotten. I could see what was in your mind when Maxwell was talking. Just because he didn't know about Jessica's coma, you thought everything he said was wrong, and that Mother's story was right. But that's ridiculous.
It is true. Why did she come out here? How can they make her move, do anything they want? They can make anybody do what they want.
You're thinking just as they want you to think. That's what it's for. The conches, their cheap mummery.
Let me in.
Come with me, Jessica.
Betsy takes her away.
You saw that?
Paul returns a steady gaze.
I saw nothing that would convince a sober man. You better get some sleep, Wes.
Later, a garden waterfall glistens down the chest of the St. Sebastian figurehead. Three long arrows pierce the wooden statue. As Betsy carries a book from the tower across the courtyard, she finds Wesley brooding among the lush plants. A cigarette burns in his hand.
Why don't you go to bed, Wes? It's been a hard day for all of us.
He shakes his head. Betsy sits down on the bench beside him.
I'm sorry, Wes. I think I know how you must feel. And I am sorry. I only wish there was something I could do.
She ought to be free.
He slowly turns and stares at her.
You could free her, Betsy. You could do it. You're a nurse. You have the drugs. It'd be so quick.
Her heart beats. She breathes. That's life, Wes. I once took an oath to guard life.
I shouldn't have asked it of you. But it was only because I can't make you believe that she's already dead. Wait a minute. There's one other thing. You love Paul.
Betsy faintly mouths yes.
And what good will it ever do you if Jessica still lives?
Wesley.
Her eyes flash angrily.
I'm afraid I love him too much for that.
I'm sorry.
Wesley drops his gaze and walks away from her. For a moment, Betsy watches him go. Then she turns back to her own bedroom door. Later, on the front porch, Wesley rests his head on his hands. The decanter and empty shot glass sit by his elbow. Lifting his head, he sees Jessica leave the tower and approach the iron gate. The strong wind outlines her white gown against her slender body. The Humfort swordsman gestures furiously, but the doll and the string remain still. He rises and whispers to another man seated inside the shed. Now Wesley stands and walks to the gate where Jessica waits, her face tilted to the side. She remains still as a statue as Wesley's measured steps draw closer. Gazing grimly at her, he squeezes the latch and opens the gate. Jessica passes through and vanishes in the shadows. Immediately, Wesley strides to the St. Sebastian fountain and pulls on the arrow in the figurehead's chest. It doesn't give, and he rocks it up and down until it easily withdraws. He carries it with him through the gate. At the Hum Fort, the doll on the string falls under the swordsman's waving hand. Crouched on one knee, he draws out a long pin, lowers it ceremoniously, then drives it into the doll's back. On a beach, Wesley rises, holding the arrow. Jessica's body lies on the sand at his feet. He stands straight, revealing a dark stain on Jessica's white gown. As he looks around at the craggy ocean rocks, a figure walks toward him. Carrie Four draws closer. His lumbering gait rocks him over the sand. Wesley lays down the arrow and scoops Jessica into his arms. Carrie Four's feet drag through the sand as he follows Wesley to the water's edge, where frothy waves crash against sharp-edged boulders. The guard's eyes are closed. His mouth hangs slightly open. Walking a few yards behind Wesley, he lifts his arms in a cradling motion and continues walking. Wesley stumbles under Jessica's weight as he turns and glares at Carrie Four. Wesley backs into the breaking waves, moving more quickly as the water surrounds his legs, then his waist. The ocean lifts him and Jessica until only their heads are visible in the dim light. Carrie Four stops when the tide laps over his bare feet. Slowly, his arms lower to his sides. A wave swallows Wesley. Later, Jessica's body lies face up in a shallow lagoon where island men fish with spears. Discovering her body, then later Wesley's, they carry the lovers back to Fort Holland. The fishermen bear Wesley on their shoulders, while Carrie Four carries Jessica alone. On the terrace, Mrs. Rand weeps into her hands, and Paul comforts Betsy.
O Lord God most holy, deliver them from the bitter pains of eternal death. The woman was a wicked woman, and she was dead in her own life. Yea, Lord, dead in the selfishness of her spirit, and the man followed her. Her steps led him down to evil. Her feet took hold on death. Forgive him, O Lord, who knowest the secret of all hearts. Yea, Lord, pity them who are dead, and give peace and happiness to the living.
Over the arrow-pierced figure of St. Sebastian, words appear. The end. Now, a logo, a lightning bolt through a triangle. RKO Radio Pictures.